May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mick McFarland, and I represent appellants Roberta Kramer, Juanita Murray, and Riverside School District. And with Your Honor's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Five, okay.
The issue, in a nutshell, that we're asking you to look at today is whether Roberta Kramer, the former superintendent of Riverside School District, and Juanita Murray, the principal of Chatteroy Elementary School, are entitled to qualified immunity.
So if there are, say, disputed factual issues, do we have jurisdiction to review the qualified immunity issue?
You do, Your Honor, and I would specifically refer to, I believe it was Judge Fletcher's fairly recent case of Pollock versus Savage, which noted that the Supreme Court, since its decision in Johnson, has repeatedly stated that a court of appeals has jurisdiction to hear an appeal of a denial of qualified immunity, notwithstanding the district court having found disputed facts. And to quote that case, because I believe the position that I'm advocating here is identical to the position the defendants had in that case.
Well, so let's just assume that the plaintiff's allegations that the defendants had a do-nothing policy are true. So I think we have to assume that for purposes of this, correct?
I do not believe so. I believe that
Well, I think for you to win, we can't resolve those factual disputes. So just assume that and then look at the evidence and look at whether there's affirmative conduct or deliberate indifference. Assuming those to be true. Don't we have to assume those to be true here?
With due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe there is evidence in the record. There are not facts that support the allegation that there was a do-nothing
policy. Okay, but the facts that she alleges about how it came down and when they did, and when they, what, how the reporting went about. We have to assume those in favor of the plaintiff appellee, right?
And I have to come back, Your Honor, to making a distinction between what the allegations are and what the underlying testimony is, because the underlying testimony was uniform that there was not a policy or practice of discouraging CPS reporting.
Counsel, that's belied by the record. It's not uniform. It's just not.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I believe that the only indication that there was any sort of policy of discouragement is in the declaration of Tiffany Zuck.
So it doesn't sound uniform.
Where it gets uniform, Your Honor, is the testimony, the deposition testimony of Ms. Zuck, when I questioned her about the statements in her declaration.
Right, I appreciate that, and I've read it all, and I think we all have carefully. And what it spells to me is serious cross-examination at trial. But you are asking us to do, I think, exactly, this is Judge Callahan's point, exactly what we don't do, an interlocutory review.
Basis. Sure. And I don't believe I am, Your Honor, because...
Why not? Please help me with that, because I'm having a hard time with your argument.
Because I'm not asking to weigh the credibility of a witness. Ms. Zuck retracted her statements in her declaration, and her testimony in the case, I'm not going to cross-examine her at trial because her deposition testimony is favorable to the district because her deposition...
Well, it is more favorable, counsel. I agree there were declarations and there was a deposition testimony that walks some of it back. There's the written policy. There's Ms. Dornquist, the classroom teacher, having made a report. She testified she made at least one report to the principal, and the principal testified she did not relay that on to the state. There's a text message back and forth between Tiffany Zuck and Ms. Dornquist, which I'm sure you've read, and it's quite inflammatory. I think this was a tragedy for everybody, and I don't want to walk people through it. I'm sure they're listening in today, but you know that record. So how can you say it's uniform?
I'm very familiar with that record, right. Your Honor. And by way of example, what Sherry Dornquist testified to is that she went to Ms. Murray not because she was concerned that GB had been abused by anyone, but because he did have some bruising on him, and it's her practice to make sure that those are documented in the school.
And Ms. Murray said she would take care of it, and then Ms. Murray testified that she did not report that on. And, you know, in this text message, Ms. Dornquist said she felt that it was hyperbole, but she said, you know, they murdered this child. She said, I will not testify for the district. She was very upset. And I want to be clear, we're not making any findings of fact here, but at summary judgment, your response to Judge Callahan is that this was not contradicted about a do-nothing policy, and I cannot agree with you.
All right, I appreciate that, Your Honor.
But I guess I feel like you're wasting your time from the standpoint of that there is, and I'm not saying you're going to win, but there is a way that you can win if you assume all of those facts to be true. Because the state-created danger exception, which is at issue here, this is a truly tragic situation. And if your clients are entitled to qualified immunity, it doesn't mean they did everything right. It doesn't mean that they could, but it's a very high bar. And if you assume all of those to be true, and as a matter of law, that is not affirmative conduct or deliberate indifference as a matter of law, they're still entitled to qualified immunity. This poor child, you know, maybe if they had done something, but they didn't put his father was murdered and the mother died and they were put with a relative and, you know, and all of those things. And if you go back and tell the school district that they couldn't have done any better, I don't think that would be very good legal advice. But that doesn't mean that they don't necessarily qualify for qualified immunity. So let's drill down and assume that what they did is you give them the inferences and talk about state-created danger.
And absolutely, Your Honor. And I got sidetracked from answering your question about the do-nothing policy, because circling back to your question and the do-nothing policy, even if there was, as you alluded to, a policy of not doing anything, they still have not shown, Ms. Davis has still not shown, the next step, and that is the basically cover-up. Instead of just not doing something, you have to be affirmatively trying to discourage the reporting of the abuse. Otherwise, you do not...
That's what Zuck said happened.
She said, Your Honor, that happened in her declaration. She retracted that.
But now you're back to...
Totally did.
But now that's what... Those are the type of things people talk at a trial. Okay, that's what they talk about at a trial. Okay, they didn't report it, you know, they didn't report it the first day. You know, whatever the reasons were or whatever, deal with... It still is a very high standard.
I agree.
And that's what you need to talk about. You don't need to talk about what a good job they did. You need to talk about why... Assume the worst, and why they still get qualified immunity.
They still get qualified immunity, Your Honor, because there are no facts that establish that a single teacher at Riverside School District believed that that GB was being abused and failed to make that report to CPS because they had been discouraged to do so. And that kind of ties into the causation element that's missing from this case.
Well, causation is going to be a big problem at trial. I will grant you that. But there are several people here in this record who had concerns about the child showing bruising and scratching and whatnot. So at the Christmas concert alone, I think there are 5 individuals who testified that they were concerned they saw scratching and whatnot. And the consistent pattern when there were reports, they went to Zuck, which was consistent with the school policy, not the district policy. And then when she was taken out of the loop, to Murray. And then Murray said she never passed any of them on.
Well, as it relates to the Christmas concert, just to be clear, Your Honor, those were reported to CPS. There was a report made on December.
That's the Zuck report.
Yes, and that was immediately after the Christmas.
You're exactly right. I see my timeline here. So there's the bandaging on covering his entire forehead in October.
Correct.
The bilateral bruising in late November on his ears and arm. That's where it was reported to Murray, and Murray said she would take care of it, and Murray later testified she didn't report it. So we can take that as an example. It's a more, you're correct to correct me. That's right. And so what about that?
And so what about the let me
answer. You just said there's a problem. You want to, I think, to rule as a matter of law on causation because you said there's no indication that anybody failed to report because of the school policies. I believe your point.
There's no evidence in the record that any teacher thought there was, or staff member thought there was potential abuse and made the decision not to report it because of a policy of discouraging abuse. And that has to be shown in order for there to be the state-created danger. Because in the absence of discouraging...
Well, it directed. The school-wide policy says it has to go. It's in capital letters. It's a direction. You have to give these reports to Zuck, to the counselor, and then to Murray. And the policy and practice it's testified to... The policy and practices testified to is that this particular principal was very insistent that she wanted a day or two to work it out with parents. And that's what happened. Especially if we talk about the practice, there is testimony to that effect.
So
rather than these people are all mandatory reporters, rather than complying with the district policy to report immediately. So I'll be quiet now and let you respond, but that's what I'm struggling with.
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record, Your Honor, none, that any teacher, staff member, considered GB to have been abused or suspected that he was abused. Now, going back to whether this is tragic and whether they did their job as mandatory reporters is a different issue.
Okay, what do you do then with these, just for example, this is a big record, so I'm not going to take you through all of it, of course, but what about this text message between Ms. Dornquist and Tiffany Zuck? The classroom teacher who did have concerns and did report them, and at least on one occasion it wasn't passed through, she reported bilateral bruising on ears and arms. Her comments here are scathing.
And those concerns that she had about the bilateral bruising, she did take to Ms. Murray. And remember, she said she took it to Ms. Murray because Ms. Murray has great rapport with children, and she wanted Ms. Murray to go talk with GB to find out about them. Ms. Murray testified she did. And that GB kept saying, his cousin. And so she believed at the time that the bruising was from roughhousing with the cousin.
But Counselor, but you're making a closing argument about how I'd evaluate the evidence, and I am not on the jury.
Understood. But it goes to whether there was this evidence of discouraging reporting. Because
okay,
Ms. Murray,
Here's the deal. And I'm interrupting you. Forgive me. But
that's all right.
On the state, we're only talking state-created danger. We're not talking about special relationship. And to get back to Judge Callahan's question, we have to show an affirmative step taken by the school. And then, so we're still talking about the affirmative step, right?
Correct.
And why isn't the policy or practice of discouraging reporting an affirmative step? What's your best answer there?
My best answer there is there's not evidence of discouragement.
I'll take this as a hypothetical then, given what you just said. If there is a policy or practice of discouraging, is that state-created danger?
If there is a policy of practice of discouraging abuse... And
discouraging reporting is what we're talking
excuse
about.
Excuse me, discouraging reporting abuse. And that policy in this case applied to these facts led a teacher or staff member to not make a report, then yes, I would agree there would be an issue of state-created danger.
The question is whether there's enough evidence in the record to go to trial on that point.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right.
Let's hear from the other side.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
If it may please the court, my name is James Ware. I'm here today with my co-counsel, Mark Kimball. We're here on behalf of appellee, Ms. Davis. To answer an initial question, I think
we all start from the fact that this is a terribly tragic situation and no one ever, the school did not put the child there. Okay, so it's different than some of our cases where, say, like, a child placement happened with a known sexual predator or something. And so here, it's undisputed that the child ended up there by other people. It's not, we're not talking about the child welfare or whatever. We're, so the school didn't put the child there. So we have to deal with what the school, you know, they're not, so it's the.
Correct, Your Honor. And what I guess what I wanted to start off with, and perhaps it's.
And they couldn't remove the child from there either, right? All the school can do is report suspected abuse.
Correct, Your Honor.
And then whatever happens, and if they, let's just say it would be worse facts for you if they had reported immediately the first time they saw anything in the child that they reported it, and then whatever, I don't know, we call in California Child Protective Services, you call it something else here. Let's say they sat on it for 2 months and the child, they, without investigating it or doing a home visit, and then the child died, then you'd be suing them, right?
Correct, Your Honor. That's a different fact scenario.
Right.
Our relationship or the relationship of the RSD with this case would be much different. I guess I wanted to start out
with. So even reporting it, that would not result in the child being immediately removed. It would have to go to a court process and it would have to be an investigation and then decide what happened.
Correct, Your Honor. And in fact, in December when.
Are you saying there's no provision in Washington law for immediately removing a child from harm?
No.
There's statutory. Yes, in response to Judge Callahan's question. So it and seems to me you're getting way beyond the record, counsel.
I'm sorry. I had. There is a provision within Washington statutes that does allow for an immediate removal of a child
but
from
not
a
for
home.
The school, not for the school to do
no,
it. It would be the reporting
social
agent.
Worker.
Or the police. It depends on if they're contacting
and
DSH.
And that didn't happen, and we don't know what
would
have happened.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor. So sitting here today, the court is going to take as given the facts that the district court assumed when it denied summary judgment, simply for a legal reason, to determine if there is an abstract issue of law related to qualified immunity that warrants reversal. I think that the briefing on this is so heavily skewed towards a factual dispute about the credibility of certain witnesses, about why, for example, Ms. Dornquist went to Murray twice. She went in October of 2014 for bruising on the forehead. Then she went in November of 2014 because of the bilateral bruising and bruising on arms. Well, the question becomes, if she didn't suspect that there was any signs of abuse, why was she going to, as we allege, the gatekeeper to determine what to do about it?
The briefing is really, unfortunately, skewed towards disputed issues of fact. Mm. But if we could get back to what you have to show, because they're entitled to review at summary judgment about the constitutional question for sure.
Correct. And
what's your best argument that there's a showing here sufficient to show that there was a state-created danger, an affirmative act? What's your best shot?
The affirmative act is very simple, that there is evidence on the record that there was a policy of using either, you can phrase it as do nothing or using Murray as a gatekeeper that deviated from mandatory reporting. And what that result was is that the staff at CES would not make an independent decision of to report or not. All they would do is go to, quote unquote, the next person, which was Murray. That action, had that policy not been in place, we can presume, and the court presumed, and it's indicated in the court's decision on the 12B6 at ER 3247, that the staff would have simply followed Washington law on mandatory reporting and reported themselves, that the absence of that gatekeeper, the presence of the gatekeeper put him in a worse off situation than had the policy not actually existed.
Now, you're talking about policy. Are you talking about a policy in the school, or are you talking about policy of the district? You're talking about both.
Well, I'm talking about both, Your Honor. What's critical here is that at CES, we have in the handbook a statement or the policy written in the handbook said
Counsel, can you be clear about district handbook versus school handbook?
Yes.
Because I think Judge Felcher is asking about the school policy and how it deviated from the district policy.
So the school policy states that the reporter must report this to CES counsel, and that's at ER 1113. The district policy says that, uses slightly different language, where it says that you have to report it to the school counselor. And the issue here is that at CES, at the school level, that Murray, and we argue with the blessing of Dr. Kramer, went beyond simply what was written in the school handbook and had this informal policy of trying to keep everything in-house.
Right. Well, here's what I'm driving at. We've got two different categories of defendants. We've got the school district and we've got individuals. And the school district, of course, is not entitled to qualified immunity. But if we're going to hold the school district liable, we've got to find policy, custom, or practice under Monell. We need to find that, which is different from what we need to find as against the individuals. And I'll use the word policy or custom with respect to the individuals, but in a different sense from Monell. But if we find that, say, Murray, as the leader of the school, had a policy or practice of discouraging the complaints going beyond her, that may be enough for her. So I'm asking you to differentiate when you're talking about policy, custom, or practice as to whose you're talking about.
I see, Your Honor. Yes, and so for Murray, the she created it's our position she created the policy at the school district or at the school at CES,
and that this was. We're not talking about written policy. We're talking about policy as enacted or effectuated by her actions.
Correct.
No, and no, wait a minute. There's a written policy at the school. That's what Judge Fletcher's asking.
Yes, there was the written policy, but I guess it's our position that she even goes beyond the strictly written policy.
This is really an important point.
Okay.
Can you back up and answer Judge Fletcher's question again? Because I think the record's now very muddled.
The policy at the school deviated from the statute.
Was it written?
Yes, it was. It says, any school personnel who has reasonable cause to believe that a child is suffering injuries, suffering physical neglect, or sexual abuse, all caps, must report this to CES counsel first. And then the counselor...
Counselor. CES counselor, meaning the school counselor.
Correct, Your Honor. And this is at... it's quoted by the district court at ER 11-3. And then the counselor will then report to the Department of Child Protective Services. So, again, this is the written policy, and it's our position that that deviates from the statute because the statute places the onus on the mandatory reporter. Further, it's our position that Murray went beyond this and actually instilled a culture, a custom of making sure that things were kept in-house and that there was a strong gatekeeper before anybody reported to CPS. And it could have been, and the record indicates, it was either Murray or the counselor, but that the key was is that these individuals served as the gatekeeper. And the record indicates, at least on two instances with GB, that Murray was serving as the gatekeeper as to whether or not a reporting would occur. And again, that was with Sherry Dornquist on October 2014 and then in November of 2014. So that's the written policy at the school level, and that was instilled by Murray. And so she was the policymaker at that level. For Dr. For Dr. Kramer, the issue here is that she was she oversaw the district-wide policy. She was in constant contact with Murray, and that she acquiesced and approved the policies at CES. And so for that, I believe that under Monell, the she was adopting the policies. And so under Monell, I do believe that attaches liability at the district level.
Well, as to Monell and the district, this is not an interlocutory appeal as to them, right?
Well, that is correct. And I guess, can you rephrase your question, Your Honor? Because perhaps
I've heard enough. Thank you.
Okay. So assuming...
So this woman that was taking care of the child, she was acquitted?
Yeah, she was acquitted. It's outside of the record, but I could discuss more about kind of the case. But what happened was is that, at least my understanding of it was, is that there was an expert witness who testified on her behalf. It was a pediatric neurologist, I believe, who testified that in theory, a child could sustain the injuries to the head by falling off of a bunk bed that GB had.
Are you asking us to consider what you're telling us now that's outside the record, or what do you want us to do with this? I just want to signpost it in my notes.
But I mean, essentially, we could judicially notice that, but you can't really tell why. The prosecutor obviously didn't prove her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt to a second-degree murder.
Yes, Your Honor, you are correct that Ms. Clear,
either by virtue of accident or another person in the house, or it could be.
She was acquitted, and I would point out that in our case, that the issue here doesn't rest solely on who caused the injuries to him.
Well, there's no issue that the school didn't cause it. The school didn't inflict. They didn't happen at school.
Correct,
there's no. That's undisputed, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, okay.
So, again, I do believe that we have established that the policy was a state-created danger. Additionally, Your Honors, I would argue that as far as deliberate indifference, there is enough evidence to survive summary judgment. Deliberate indifference case law indicates that it's a very facts or case-specific issue and often rests on weighing evidence, and therefore whether actions amount to deliberate indifference or mere negligence tends to be a factual issue.
Would a factor be how bad the injuries looked as to whether it would be deliberate indifference? You know, let's just say that, you know, you don't report it and you've got a gaping hole in your neck or, you know, something like that. I mean, those are better facts for deliberate indifference as opposed to, and I'm not saying these are the facts, but like a scratch on the hand.
Well, and
I mean, we would have to look at what the undisputed facts are about what the injuries look like.
Correct. And what I would state is that the trier of fact would look at the pictures and determine, the jury would look at the pictures and determine, are these mere scratches that look like kids playing, or is it something more significant?
How old was this child? 5?
Yes.
He had an IEP. Was he, I read somewhere that he had compromised verbal skills. Is that right?
He did. Unfortunately, he suffered from severe neglect at an early age, so he was developmentally delayed. He had never been diagnosed.
Okay. And counsel, when Ms. Zook was taken off and directed no longer work with this child because the foster mother had caused quite a scene, a lot of hollering after she'd been reported to the state, was another counselor assigned to look out for this child? Was there somebody else?
Well, he was in a...
Just a yes or a no. Can you tell me? Your time's ticking. Was there a counselor assigned?
No.
Okay. And then my other question is, was the classroom teacher, Ms. Dornquist, then notified by Ms. Murray that this report to DSHS had been made?
Yes. I don't recall exactly where in the record, but the staff was aware of it.
As of when?
And again, I don't recall exactly in the record. It would have been, I believe it was in January of 2015.
Thank you.
So, Your Honor, because this court does not weigh the facts and the credibility of the testimony on an interlocutory appeal of the denial of qualified immunity, I believe that the appellants have not met their burden to show that the district court erred, and for that reason, I would ask that you affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. You've saved some time. Would you put 2 minutes on?
Thank you, Your Honor. The reason the briefing was so factually intense is because of the errors in the representation first by plaintiffs to the court as to what the facts were, and then the representations or the characterizations by the court, the district court, as to those facts. And you heard one example of it is just now counsel got up and said that Ms. Dornquist went to Ms. Murray on two separate occasions about concerns about GB and abuse. That's not true. The record is that that October 2014 report, she went and told Ms. Murray, he bumped his head on a railing here at school and has a lump on it. And so there had to be a focus on the facts and what the actual evidence is. Now, going to the, Your Honor's question.
Wait, okay. Late October 2014, on a field trip, Dornquist notified GB had a bandage covering his entire forehead. Okay. Then late November 2014, Dornquist noticed bilateral bruising on GB's ears and arms. Dornquist contacted Murray about GB's injuries and asked if she should report the incident. So,
and that's the occasion where Ms. Murray went and talked to GB and then asked the school nurse to examine GB. After that, and the school nurse determined that it wasn't from abuse and therefore didn't make a call.
And then on early October, it said Dornquist noticed bruising on GB's forehead. She took a photograph and called Murray in to look at the bruising. So it looks, I'm counting two times. So you're saying that's just false, but I'm counting two times.
What Sherry Dornquist testified to was that she talked to Ms. Murray on two occasions, one about hitting his head on a rail, the other about the bilateral bruising. That's what her testimony was.
Well, you said, did I just hear you say she didn't talk to Murray twice?
She didn't talk to Ms. Murray twice about suspected abuse, no.
Well, I'm having problems with how you're characterizing the facts in terms of I have those two, those, you know, whatever you want to call that, those two things happened that she talked to Murray, and it didn't have to do with he was getting an F in her class. It had to do with things on his body.
And on one occasion, it was because he hit his head on a rail at school. That was the point, is she
was. Okay, but it had to do with injuries on his body. And what should she do about it?
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely. As it relates to your questions about policy, the school policy versus the district policy, the school policy, I submit, is not contrary to the statute, the mandatory reporting statute, because the mandatory reporting statute allows someone to cause another person to make a CPS call. However, if we assume that the school's written policy is contrary to the CPS reporting statute, that doesn't get the plaintiffs where they need to go, because that's not, it doesn't discourage the reporting. In fact, it says you must report to the counselor, who then will make the phone call.
But a written policy does not protect the school if the actual policy and practice by the school personnel is different, of course.
Meaning could
I will hypothesize that the written policy of the school is fabulous. There's no possible question of whether it's wrong. But if the school administrators don't follow the policy, we still have problems.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Okay.
I agree with you.
Okay.
As it relates,
you're over time, so if you'd sum up, that would be great.
You bet. Even if we assume that everything that has been alleged about Juanita Murray is true, she was a gatekeeper. She asked people to come to her. She then made a decision whether to report it or not, or work it out with the parents. There is no evidence in this record that those facts occurred as it relates to GB. There is no evidence that any teacher ever either went to Ms. Murray and said, I'm concerned that GB is being abused, and she didn't report it to CPS, or any teacher who testified, I would have gone, I suspected abuse, I would have gone, but I was discouraged not to. And because of that...
You said teacher. Do you want to say any person went?
Any staff member, yes. And in the absence of those facts related to GB, there isn't a state-created danger.
Okay. Thank both sides for their arguments. Davis versus Riverside School District submitted, and that concludes the morning.